Okay. You're listening to Heart of Mind Radio for the New Millennium. And this is Catherine Davis. And today I am so pleased to be speaking with Joe Weston. And Joe Weston is one who is very much involved in our cultural awareness, stand in your power and speak your truth. And he is an international workshop facilitator, author, consultant, coach, and advocate for lasting peace. His book, Mastering Respectful Confrontation, is selling throughout the world. Joe has more than 30 years of experience in providing training to corporations, government agencies, and nonprofits around the world, addressing conflict prevention and resolution, leadership development, transforming work, social culture, and deeper levels of collaboration. He is currently adjunct professor at Georgetown University School of Government, Department of Conflict Resolution, teaching a course, Body-Based Skill Building for Navigating Stress and Confrontation. And there's much more that I could say, but we're going to get right into this conversation. Joe will be appearing at the New York Open Center doing a program on cultural transformation through respectful confrontation. So I want to welcome you to this conversation and to our audience here at Heart of Mind.
Thank you, Catherine. It's a real pleasure to be here with you, and an honor.
Yes, it's a pleasure for me as well. And this is because our world so needs this. You know, when I look at the television and I go to different workspaces and even spaces where people would normally, or you would think that people would be able to negotiate with each other their exchanges and their experiences, their relationships. But our world seems to be really in a troubled place right now. And so I'm happy to talk to you about this. But start off by telling us a little something about yourself and how you came to be involved in this work.
Thank you. Well, I'm originally from New York City, from Queens, and in terms of writing a book about confrontation, I always say that's where I really got my training, because being a New Yorker is a constant examination of conflict and confrontation in the best sense of the word and sometimes the challenging sense of the word. And growing up in an environment where it was expected that I would fight and various challenges, and, you know, my father hooked up with sometimes the wrong kinds of crowds, spent some time in jail when I was around 12 years old. So I come from an environment where I really was able to watch and observe how power over, what I would call power over, exerting power, was the mode of how to be in the world, and seeing how destructive that was. And even at a very young age, asking the question, which is the fundamental through line of my whole journey with this work and ultimately writing the book, is the question being, why is it, even though we know better, even though we're a relatively intelligent species, technologically we have made a lot of advances, why is it even though we know better, we still have arguments and fights, and on a larger scale, crime and war and hunger? And I think, Catherine, you might understand this, is that most people, the answer is, well, that's just the way we are. And I was never satisfied with that answer. And so my whole journey has been about examining what makes us function in this way, that even though we know better, we still revert to these same patterns. And I think that's the power of the work that I'm doing is, you know, we can take trainings, we can, you know, go to retreats, we can study all these wonderful things that are teaching us how to cultivate, to self-actualize. But are we really applying it at every single moment, particularly in the challenging moments? And that's, you know, so for me, a crucial part of my development as a young man was being introduced to Tai Chi, which I know that you have a background in Qigong.
Yeah.
So I know you understand that. And that's where I really started understanding mind-body connection, what it means to go within, to self-reflect. You know, one of the aspects of the work I call courageous self-reflection. That's probably the most frightening thing a human being can do, is go within and truly look at themselves, the good and the bad. And I think that that's a big element of part of my development, of really seeing how I actually had power to shift my behavior if I was mindful enough. And I actually then ended up in Europe and the Netherlands, and was going to stay for a few months, and ended up staying for 18 years. And there I began to really learn a lot about the world and about culture, and really questioning in a good way my own culture. There I also deepened my qi practice and Taoist alchemy practices, and also Tibetan Buddhism, where I really, particularly the trainings in cultivating the compassionate heart, and not just talking about compassion, not just being a nice person, but actually cultivating the spontaneous desire to alleviate the suffering of others and acting on that desire. And in that time, I started doing a lot of corporate training in communication, particularly dealing with aggression. And all of those pieces, in a sense, these are the different pieces that came together to help me cultivate this work.
Excellent. And I think that there are many, many people who truly want to learn to negotiate life in this way. So I am operating under the idea that most people who tune into this program want to better their lives and want to better the world, but feel frustrated because, you know, they throw up their hands. They don't know what they could personally do. Can you speak to how, when a person begins to activate these principles in their lives, it really can have a transformative effect that is expansive?
Yeah, certainly. So when I say what is respectful confrontation, I say it's a method and a practice that helps us develop the skills and the courage to stand in your power, speak your truth, get your needs met in a way where you don't get harmed and other people don't get harmed. And that part of that is understanding, and it's not only like a concept, but it's also tapping into part of the work that I've cultivated is called the Four Pillars of True Power, where you actually, through a series of exercises, get to feel the embodied sensation of power in a new way. Just to share what the four pillars are, it's grounding, focus, strength, and flexibility. And it's how you can cultivate different ways of being in your power that is not what we typically think of as brute force. So part of it is reframing the way we see things, how true power is different from brute force, how confrontation, which is truly the most effective, a very effective way to deepen relationship and speak your truth, get your needs met, is different from conflict, and how assertiveness is different from aggression. So I think part of it is, I would say one thing is, take some time to just reflect on your own viewpoints, what I would call unexamined assumptions around power, around assertiveness and aggression, and around confrontation and conflict. And in a sense, seeing how, by really knowing what your motivation is, that you can maybe feel more confident to speak your truth more. And then the most important part is to be able to speak your truth in a way where you're not harming others, and where you're taking care of yourself so that you don't get harmed. So and it's, in a sense, those small ways. It's being able to see, like, how can I really influence my relationships? How can I bring, for those of us who are meditators, for those of us who have practices that we do, how do I take all of what I've cultivated in retreat centers and really bring it into my daily life? I bring in also the neuroscience of it in terms of understanding what is reactive behavior and how taking a look at our own, you know, responses to trauma or stress and anxiety. And being able to, you know, see how a lot of how we do harm each other is unconscious and coming from a place of fight, flight, or freeze. with a certain number of people know that concept, and to really be mindful at every moment, see how it's playing out, and really cultivate the courage and the mindfulness and the presence at that moment to say, I'm going to try something different, and I'm going to try to listen, and I'm going to, and one of the concepts I use is when you do share your truth is the concept of my truth does not equal the truth. That oftentimes we get into arguments and fights and we don't seem to get anywhere. And we see that playing out, for instance, in government, is that when we present something, we presented, I am right. And if you have a different viewpoint, you must be wrong. And that's not working. So it's a question of how can you present it in a way, whatever your truth is, just saying, listen, this is just my side of the story. And it's true to me. And I'm going to present it in that way. What you find happening is that the other person can receive it in a different way. If you present it from, I'm right, and I'm accusing you or judging you or I want justice or whatever, the other person is not going to be receptive. And in a sense, people have often said that using these principles with respectful confrontation, that in the past where there were no solutions, suddenly new solutions emerge. And this is one way, is say, I'm going to present to you my needs. I'm going to present to you my truth. And then to have the courage to say, now that I presented my side, I'm willing to listen to your side. And by listening to your side doesn't mean I have to agree with it. It simply is, I'm going to give you the respect, the compassion, the understanding, and the honor to say that whatever your experience is your viewpoint of it. It's your perception of it. And what you find is that when people can, in a sense, throw their truth on the table and the other person throws their truth on the table, if you're willing to stay in that uncomfortable place, that's the creative place. And that's where new solutions can emerge. And that's where reconciliation can emerge. If you can put your needs on the table, and the other person has the clarity and the courage to put their needs on the table, even if the needs seem to contradict each other, if you stay in that uncomfortable place, it can be wildly creative, and that can change the world. It can certainly transform you as a person. It can transform your relationships. It can transform your community. And I believe it can transform the world.
Mm. I do as well. And I found it really interesting when you were speaking in the early part of that, those few phrases, and you were saying that people get triggered and they really are sort of falling into their neurology and not even conscious of their reactive behaviors. So, and I think this is what happens to a lot of us. We get triggered, we engage in a reactive behavior before we realize that it's happened. Is there a strategy for taking a step back from that situation?
Yes, I think that, I'm assuming a lot of your listeners have a lot of skills already with mindfulness practice, meditative practice, Qigong or Tai Chi, and various other self-actualization or spiritual practices. And I think it's, use them in creative ways. And really, it's about, the word I use is resilience. It's about, when you're walking down a busy street, when you're on the subway, those are the moments to practice. First, practice, can I bring in all the skills and knowledge and wisdom that I already have? And I, as I'm sitting on the subway and it's getting more and more crowded because it's 5 p.m. on a Thursday or whatever, can I just check in and notice what's going on in my nervous system? Can I take a breath to ease the activation? Do I remember that my feet are on the ground? As I'm sure you know this from Catherine, I work with the Dantian, with the core. And I say this, I've done work with severely wounded combat veterans, helping them navigate their nervous system and learn how to regulate in a new way and to communicate in an effective way. And my mantra is feet on the ground, focus in my center. So the first step is the noticing. Oh, I'm beginning to get activated. There's no judgment in that. You don't need to say it's good or bad. There's no value to it. It's simply a noticing. And then creating the new habituation, the new habit of saying, I'm getting activated, feet on the ground, focus in my center, open my heart. And for me, open-heartedness is the key to the work. That open-heartedness doesn't mean you have to love someone. It doesn't mean, it simply means that you're willing to be respectful and that you're willing to connect and be present to them in a way that's safe for you and doesn't harm them.
I love that. And I want to let everyone know that there is going to be opportunities for all of you to connect with Joe Weston in New York City, in the New York City area. Easy to get to the New York Open Center on 30th Street, I believe it is. On March 15th, you're going to be offering an evening lecture and book signing, and that's from 7 to 9 p.m. And then on Saturday, March 16th, you're doing a class, Personal Transformation Through Respectful Confrontation, and that is from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. So everyone will have an opportunity to learn some of these techniques and strategies and being able to start at least on that path if we haven't already. And you can go to opencenter.org and search for the information, Joe Weston, JOEWSWESTON, Cultural Transformation Through Respectful Confrontation. And I would love for you to share a bit about what people will experience when they come to see you here in New York.
Sure, thank you. So there are two events, and the content, you know, the methodology is similar. It's about respectful confrontation. The evening lecture it will be experiential. It won't just be talking. It'll also be bringing in some of my practices that people can take home and practice on if they think it might resonate for them, practice on a regular basis. And that one is called Cultural Transformation Through Respectful Confrontation, because that's the focus. If I may bring in also some of the other work I'm doing, is I've been working for a number of years now with women's rights organizations in the Middle East. And this idea, and basically I've created a program to help women's rights organizations shift the paradigm of the masculine principle it's basically to address gender-based violence and reframing masculinity in a way that's more respectful, dealing with aggression. And it really has to do with what's going to shift in our cultures, our viewpoints, our habits, and our patterns. That, again, you know, we can have the information, but having the information, if that was going to change things, it would have changed already. What is it going to take for us to take that information, contemplate it, get it into our hearts, and then get it down into our core and in our bodies and actually create the new habits, the new viewpoints and the pattern? And so the evening lecture is really framing how can we actually, each one of us, be a part of our evolution as a species, in a sense, towards more open-heartedness, towards respect and honor and equality for all and equity for all, this idea of a cultural transformation. And I always say that I don't think in that transformation is going to happen on the battlefields it happens at the kitchen table. It happens at work. It happens online at the supermarket. Each one of us taking responsibility for shifting our own patterns and addressing people in a different way. So that's the framework for the cultural transformation part of it, which will be lecture, discussion, and experiential. The one day, it's about personal transformation. It's taking a day to really go deeper into the four pillars of true power, some of these concepts, and experiencing, again, in your body as well as theory. How can you, the very question you were asking, how can I actually walk away at the end of that day with some concrete ways to begin that process of shifting my own patterns? And cultivating what I would say, which is key to this work, is a deeper level of resilience. And I think in this day and age, with what's happening in this country, certainly for the last 2 or 3 years, and in the world, we need to cultivate a deep, with all of our practices, we need to cultivate a deeper level of resilience to be able to navigate the anxieties and the stress. And also what I call cultivating a true sense of fierce compassion. And that's the essence of the work, is resilience and fierce compassion.
Hmm. I love that, fierce compassion. It, yeah. You know, it really does make me realize what it means, or this is one way of looking at how to be that sort of peace warrior or spiritual warrior. You want to engage in a very powerful way, but you don't want to engage with the tactics that you are attempting to, or the ways and strategies that people are engaging in the world. So it strikes me that this is a very powerful alternative for all kinds of people engaged in bringing peace about in the world. And so I'm really grateful for what you're bringing. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And
thank
what
you.
About the Saturday?
Well, that's the Friday evening is the cultural transformation. The Saturday, the one day, we have more time to delve into the more of the methodology and more of the practice. Like I said, really looking at the four pillars and feeling in your body what power feels like. And, you know, one of the concepts that I use as the basis of respectful confrontation is that it's in your vulnerability that your true power is revealed. And so it's about helping us work through some of our own enculturation, thousands of years of enculturation, where that concept has been beaten out of us in a sense, where we've lost contact with what the power of open-heartedness. And that vulnerability doesn't mean weakness or submission. It's actually, I'm seeing that in the corporate work I'm doing and the organizational work I'm doing, that leaders are being expected to be effective leaders. They're being expected to come from their vulnerability and transparency. I call it 21st century leadership. So in this one-day training, we create a safe environment where people, to the level that they feel comfortable, really embody what that means. And because why I bring that up is because I believe each and every one of us, we are already truly powerful. We can't do anything to become more powerful. We already are fully powerful in our core. The work is letting go of all the distractions and fears and self-talk that keeps us from accessing that true power. And it's unlimited. And this is where I bring in a lot of the Qi principles. If we can really connect with our Dantian, and I say, feel our feet on the ground, connect with our Dantian, our center, connect with our hearts, we can access unlimited resources of energy. So the exercises we'll be exploring in the one day are ways of embodying and feeling in our bodies so the somatic experience of what power feels like. That, again, is not brute force. Because as the more we can do these exercises and remember that power is simply flow, is freedom, is playfulness, is creative, is life-enhancing, then we can begin to let go of what culture has told us is that power means brute force and someone has to get harmed if you're in your power.
That's amazing. And for people who want to learn more about your work, they could always visit you also at your website, respectfulconfrontation.com. And I would certainly advise everyone to look at the website, opencenter.org, and you will find the information right here about these upcoming events. And again, it's an evening lecture and book signing, Friday, March 15th from 7 to 9 p.m. And there's a class on Saturday, March 16th from 10 a.m. till 5:30 p.m., Personal Transformation Through Respectful Confrontation. And I would love to see so many people in in this workshop and interfacing with your work, Joe, because it is very much needed, and it's a big piece, I think, of what we should be looking at in so many of today's movements, whether that's a spiritual so-called New Age movement, or it's an activist who's out there in the streets protesting, or if it's someone who's in a corporation that doesn't have good skills or understanding about what it means to be a human in any place and at any time. And it seems to me that that's what you are sharing with us all. So that's pretty special. And time goes by so quickly. I want to give you an opportunity if you want to share with our listeners any final thoughts.
Yeah, it's a couple of things, and I appreciate you saying that, and Catherine, because I do hope people show up, not necessarily just because I want to make sure there's a lot of people, but I think that it can be really of benefit to people and give some sense of hope and some tools for resilience, as I said. But it also follows along with another important premise of my work, which is we need to gather. We need to find ways of gathering. So one of the things I always say, if you think about it, if only hanging out with people who already agree with you were going to solve our world problems, we would have already solved our world problem.
Mm.
So in a sense, that's not working. So for me, the next logical question is what would work? And that is we have to learn how to gather and connect with people that are different, that we don't know, and have the courage and the skills and the wisdom and the compassion and the resilience to stay engaged. And that's where the new solutions will emerge. And that's where we will cultivate a deeper level of ourselves, because we get to reflect in a different way. So that I want to bring that in as any ways that you can connect, any of us can connect with people we don't know that feel safe, of course, is going to accelerate the process of transformation. And one last thing is this idea of open-heartedness. You know, when I say open-heartedness, I'm not encouraging that people walk around with their hearts totally open, because we would go insane, particularly if you live in a city like New York City. And unfortunately, because we are so polarized in our thinking, we think, well, I only have two choices. Either my heart is totally open, which I couldn't do that. I go crazy in 3 minutes. So my only other option, unfortunately, is to close my heart, which is a shame, because that's what I think is reflected in the world right now, is a lot of people with a closed heart. And that's like having an on-off switch on your heart. And I say, I think it's time for us all to upgrade, get rid of the on-off switch and upgrade to a dimmer switch on our hearts, where we have power at any moment to decide how open our heart is. And that even if your heart is open 1%, out of 100%, then there's still 1% more possibility for reconciliation and transformation than there was the day before.
Beautiful. And we've been speaking with Joe Weston. He's an international workshop facilitator. Go to opencenter.org to find out about his upcoming work there. And you can go to his website as well, the RespectfulConfrontation.com. Thank you very much for joining me today. And bye for now. I'm sure we'll speak again.
Thank you, Catherine.
Okay. Bye-bye now. And coming up, we're going to be speaking with another wonderful person in the world doing amazing work. And our guest in this segment is Gretchen Rubin. Gretchen Rubin is one of today's most influential and thought-provoking observers of happiness and human nature. She's known for her ability to convey complex ideas with humor and clarity. Gretchen is an Oprah's Super Soul 100 member and is author of the bestseller Happier at Home, The Four Tendencies, The Happiness Project, and her new book, Outer Order, Inner Calm, which comes out in the spring of this year. Her website is GretchenRubin.com. And Gretchen is joining us to talk about this most recent work, Outer Order, Inner Calm, Declutter and Organize to Make More Room for Happiness. And I want to say hello and welcome, Gretchen, to Heart of Mind Radio.
I'm so happy to be talking to you today.
It is fabulous. And I have to tell you, I so need this idea of declutter and organize to make more room for happiness. I feel like I'm a really happy and peaceful person, but this lack of organization that I experience sometimes gets in the way. It's very literally like tripping over something you plopped on the floor and then you can't get to what you want to do. So please talk about this achieving inner calm and happiness, but also the declutter part. If it's not physical, it could be emotional. If it's not emotional, it's psychological. There's so much that can get in our way. So I welcome what you have to share, but would love to start with how you came to this. What was your journey?
Well, I started writing about happiness and good habits and human nature about 10 years ago. And as you said, I've written several books on these subjects. And one thing that surprised me is that whenever I would talk about anything related to outer order, something like make your bed, people got unusually energized. Like they were happy to talk about things like, how do you make more time to volunteer? How do you get more sleep? Or how do you exercise more? How do you spend more time with the people you love? That was all very interesting, but there was something about outer order where, as you suggested, there's something very emotional about it. It really seemed to touch a nerve much more than really made sense, because we can all agree that in the context of a happy, meaningful life, something like a crowded coat closet or a messy desk is trivial, but yet it seems to get in our way. Just as you said, it feels like it's weighing us down. It feels like it's limiting our vision in some way, far beyond the actual concrete manifestation in the world. And so I just wanted to explore that. Like, why is that? And then what do you do about it?
Well, I'm so eager to hear a little bit of the answer to that question, because it really does seem to be something connected to old habits and old fears and maybe insecurities. We don't really want to test ourselves to see if we can succeed. Am I getting close to what some of the issues are?
Well, I think what you're talking about is a major challenge for people, which is the fantasy self. And sometimes we have possessions that we don't really use, we don't really love, that actually maybe kind of make us feel bad whenever we see them, but they're tied to a fantasy self. So, you know, maybe I bought a guitar and a music stand and some music because I'm totally going to teach myself how to play guitar, but I'm not going to teach myself to play guitar. I could, but I'm not. And really, I won't. But seeing the guitar makes me feel bad because it reminds me of this fantasy of the kind of person that I could be, but that I'm really not. But it's not really meaningful to me because it's not something that's actually of use. Now, this can be tricky because we do want to expect more from ourselves. We want to push ourselves. And so sometimes you do want to think about, well, maybe I feel a little bit uncomfortable about the idea of doing yoga, but I'm really going to make myself do it and give it a good try. And that's good. But then sometimes we just buy things almost thinking that if I buy the stuff, it'll make me do something. Like if I buy a treadmill, I'll exercise. It's like, no, it has to come from your head. You can't just buy the stuff. But sometimes we do, and then we're left with all this stuff, and then it makes us feel bad because clearly it's not being used. And usually we've spent, you know, time, energy, and money on getting it. And now we have to figure out what to do with it too.
Yes, I so can hear you with that. So how do we work with this? And, you know, not everyone has the big clutter. Some people, like you said, have a cluttered desk, or maybe their schedules are not properly organized so they don't get what they need to be when they need to be there. And maybe you can explain how these little ways that we've developed are actually interfering with our calmness and our happiness? What's going on there?
Well, I think for many people, a really useful test is the test that I use, which is, do I love it? Do I need it? Do I use it? Because if you don't need it, use it, or love it, you probably, it's like, why do you have it? So sometimes we love something that we don't really need or use. Like, I have these vintage paper hats that my mother gave to me, and I never use them. I don't know what to do with them, but they're gorgeous, and I love them. And I'm like, I have enough room in my home and my heart for something like that. And then there's things that you use, like you have a pair of scissors that it's not, you don't particularly love them or admire them, but they're useful, so you keep them around. And then there's things that you need. So maybe you live in a part of the country where you don't often need very heavy winter clothing, but every once in a while, from time to time, you need long underwear. So you don't really regularly use it, but from time to time, you need it. And so it's good to have it because you're probably going to need that. But if you don't need it, use it, or love it, you probably should get rid of it. And this is things like mystery cords and chargers to devices that you don't even know what they go to anymore, or a bunch of junk that's jammed under your bed. You don't even know what's under there. You know, get it out and then figure out what to do with it. And that just kind of makes your life feel unclogged. And what also happens is that when you go through an area, whether it's a closet or a cupboard or a bookshelf or a desk drawer, you can get rid of the things that you don't need, use, or love, but you also become more engaged with the things you actually have. And you realize, oh, I have this tape dispenser. I forgot I even had that. I have a three-hole punch, and that's good. And what's very strange and kind of paradoxical is I'm always trying to force myself on my friends to let me help them clear clutter, because it's like contact high of all the fun of clearing clutter without any of the emotional drain that comes from having it be your own stuff. So I love to force myself on people. And what people often report, and I also feel this way, is that sometimes people think that if they get rid of things they don't need, use, or love, their lives might feel stripped, and they'll feel like they have less. But the weird thing is that when you donate, recycle, or toss the things that you don't engage with, then you feel more engaged with the things you have. So you feel actually like your life is more abundant. And it's very common for me to, like, help a friend clear a closet. There'll be two big bags of clothes that we're going to take to the thrift store to give away. And the person will say, wow, I feel like I have so much more to wear. It's obviously not true because there's far fewer items in the closet, but you feel like you have more because you want to wear everything that you have. And so sometimes people, I think, are like, I need to keep the things I have because I want my life to feel rich. But weirdly, your life often feels more rich and your stuff feels more energized and useful when you've gotten rid of all the things that you don't really want to engage with.
That actually makes a lot of sense to me. I was wondering if when you are helping people or when people refuse help, do you encounter a person's sense of embarrassment or shame, and how do you get people to the other side of that?
Absolutely, and it's really surprising because, you know, I'm not a professional organizer. Like, I don't go to strangers. These are all friends. And I have friends, and I'll say, oh, I want to come help you clear your clutter. And they'll be too embarrassed. They won't let me come over. Or they'll say, you have to give me time to clean up, and then you can come. And I'm like, and one of the things is my sister, I have a podcast called Happier with Gretchen Rubin, and my sister is my co-host. And we talk often about the fact she's very messy. I mean, she's truly clutter blind. She's one of these people that just really doesn't see clutter. It doesn't bother her. If she lived by herself, she would never close a kitchen cabinet door again. And so I say to my friends, nothing you can do will shock me. I mean, my sister literally moved 3 times with the same bag of unopened mail that she never dealt with until, like, I got there. We opened up her oven, and I was helping her move apartments, and she had jammed a bunch of junk in her oven that she had totally forgotten about. Like, I have seen it all. I don't care. For me, it's fun. Like, I like doing this. The worse it is, the better it will get. And that's how I get, that's how I feel fun. But they still won't, they feel embarrassed. And so that's why with this book, I've thrown out a ton of ideas, because I think if you do, that's one of the bad things that can come from clutter, is this feeling of embarrassment. It can mean that you don't feel hospitable, so you don't engage with other people very much because you feel you're worried that they're going to come over. Maybe you don't want repairs in your home because you don't want a plumber to come in and see what things look like, or you don't want the electrician to come or the air conditioner repair person to come because you just feel embarrassed. And I think sometimes people feel like, well, I have to spend the entire weekend doing this and I don't have that kind of time, or I don't want to spend my time that way, or I don't have the time, energy, or money to go out and buy fancy hangers or, but so a lot of things that we can do are things that you can just do, you know, little by little, very, very small steps, very manageable, something you can do just as part of your ordinary day. And the fact is, we often overestimate what we could do in a short amount of time. Like, what can I get done in an afternoon? What can I get done in a day? We overestimate how productive we can be, but we underestimate how much we can get done little by little if we just do something consistently. If you clear one shelf or one drawer or even half a drawer, half a shelf every day for a month, you will see real progress. And you can do that in 5 minutes. You know, you're waiting to leave the house because it's not time for you to arrive someplace. So you're like, okay, what am I going to do for 5 minutes? Or what am I going to do during a commercial break? Or what am I going to do while I'm waiting for the coffee to brew? I'm just going to do one thing. And as you make progress, you will start to dig yourself out of it. And also, people often get energized by the process itself. So when you start, it feels very hard. But then when you begin, I remember I was helping a friend clear clutter, and for the first time, he could see the floor of his closet, his main coat closet. And he was so excited, he took a picture of it, because just seeing the floor just felt so good. He felt so liberated from all that junk that had just been visual noise for him. And so then that made him want to do more. So sometimes, like, you think, oh, I can only do a little bit, but then you can just do a little bit. That's fine. And sometimes you might want to end up doing more. So it might be easier than you anticipate.
Yeah, I can really relate to that. Most often when you're starting something new, there's always a bit of a uphill climb, whether it's transforming your diet or getting in an exercise program. But once you get moving a little bit, it does feel so much better when your system really begins to respond to that change. So that's the encouraging news about it. And just to remind everyone, I'm speaking to Gretchen Rubin, and she's doing an evening lecture and book signing, Outer Order, Inner Calm, Declutter, and Organize to Make More Room for Happiness. And it's Tuesday, March 5th, so it's coming up very soon, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And you should go to opencenter.org, and you can search for Gretchen. Her name is spelled Gretchen Rubin, Rubin. And for those of you that register for this, you actually get a copy of the book. So it's like a bonus for everyone who participates. Not only will you be inspired by the talk, but you have the actual book in your hands, and you can take it home and get started. Gretchen, we have more time. I'm looking at your website, Gretchen Rubin, and I see that you have a lot of things happening. Could you talk a little bit about people can connect with you through the website, through blog, however it is that you want to share that, and how do you help people in that way, even though you can't go to everybody's house? How do you help them do what they need to do?
You're exactly right. I have a website called GretchenRubin.com, and you helpfully spelled my name. And there's tons of resources there. You can read about all my books. I've written about happiness. I wrote a book called Better Than Before that's all about how to change habits if you want to make or break a habit. It turns out it's not as hard as you might think if you do it in the way that's right for you. That's the secret. Don't think that there's one magic solution for everyone. And there's a lot of resources there too. So if you want to read a free excerpt of a book to see if it's the right thing for you, or you want to listen to a clip of an audiobook to hear if it's something that you would want to listen to, or I have all kinds of one pagers and discussion guides and checklists, things to help. I also have a podcast, as I mentioned, called Happier with Gretchen Rubin, where each week I talk about how to be happier with my sister, Elizabeth Kraft, who is a very successful television writer in Hollywood. So we have a lot in common, but we're also very different. So we talk about how to be happier. And I'm also on social media under Gretchen Rubin, you know, on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. And I love to connect with listeners and viewers and readers about their insights, their observations, their questions. My subject really is human nature. Like, who are we? Why do we do what we do? How can we change if we want to change? And my last several books have all looked at different aspects of this. Happiness, how to be happier at home, which for many people is sort of at the core of a happy life, how to change habits. I came up with a personality profile that divides people into four categories, upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. And if you go to my website, you can take a very short free quiz to tell you about yourself. I think 2 million people now have taken this quiz. Or you can go to GretchenRubin.com/quiz and take that quick quiz and learn a little. It's actually very, very useful information to know about yourself or about other people, because you understand, like, if you're puzzled, like, why do people all do this? It doesn't make any sense to me. Maybe it's because of their tendency. And then, as you mentioned, my most recent book is about this weird connection between outer order and inner calm for most of us. It seems to matter more than you would think. So that's what I got going on.
It makes a lot of sense. And because how a person approaches life is going to impact how that they can help themselves. So that's pretty cool. So can you, getting back to your talk and your newest book, when you're speaking about outer order and inner calm, decluttering and organizing to make more room for happiness, that's a pretty cool title in itself. But how does a person's personality type, as you just described it, connect with what you'll be sharing on Tuesday? You don't have to do them all, but just to give people a sense of how they can really understand themselves better in order to process some of the solutions that you're offering them.
Well, the four tendencies can play into outer order in some ways, but a lot of the book is aimed at throwing out ideas that might work for you no matter what your tendency is. And I really emphasize things that I see many, many people responding to, and also maybe things that you haven't thought about. So, for instance, one thing that people will often say to me when I'm like, okay, can I come over and help you clear your clutter, is they'll say, yes, I want to do this. I want to get organized. And I always say, no, don't get organized. That is not the first step. Because a lot of times when people want to get organized, they run out to the store and they buy a filing cabinet or like weird fancy hangers or like all different kinds of boxes. And they think, okay, now I'm going to jam more stuff into place. But for just about everyone, the answer is no, stop and think, what can I get rid of? If I don't use it, need it, or love it, I don't need to keep it. If I don't need these documents, I can just shred them and get rid of them. I don't need a filing cabinet to put them in. And over, I've seen people think, oh, wow, I just don't know how I'm going to deal with all this. But then when you get rid of the stuff that doesn't belong, well, then there's just plenty of room on the plain, ordinary shelf. You don't have to do anything special to organize it. So I really, at this talk, I'm going to emphasize the things that I think work for pretty much everyone. Or here's a funny thing. If you can't find something, clean up. This works like a charm. I am astonished by how often I think, well, oh, I can just see that something isn't, you know, on this shelf or on this chair. And then if I'm like, okay, well, I got to clean up, you put things away, you hang up the coat, up, and there it is. You know, you wouldn't have thought it could fit right in the place where you wouldn't see it, but there it is. So I'm going to be talking about just like a bunch of ideas. This is a very quick, playful book. It throws out a bunch of short ideas to kind of get people fired up, you know, to just toss the book over their shoulder and go running to the medicine cabinet to get rid of everything they don't want. And so so the talk will be really highlights of that, of the things that are the most universally useful.
Well, that sounds wonderful. It's almost as if you're taking the stress out of the whole situation, because just like people get these boxes and put all their stuff in it, then they need more boxes and more boxes. There's that emotional clutter connected to each box. So if you can do this stress-free, I think that that's a very powerful strategy for people to find that calmness and to bring some order into their lives. And you speak about this in a way that is non-self-judgmental, because I think that's a bigger problem than other people judging. People judge themselves. And if you're turning it into a sort of a game, which it kind of sounds like to me, easier solutions, that's actually quite powerful.
Well, and it's funny because you're exactly right about the judgment. And I think sometimes people really feel like they're wrong or they should be different from the way they are. And this comes up, for instance, with abundance lovers and simplicity lovers. So simplicity lovers are people like me, and I like empty shelves and bare counters, and I don't like a lot going on. I don't like very many choices. Then there are abundance lovers, and they love profusion and choice and collections and a lot of stimulation. And sometimes you'll get like a boss who says things like, a cluttered desk means a cluttered mind. Everyone should like have one Moleskine notebook and one perfect pen and a laptop, and that's all you should have on your desk. Well, that works if you're a simplicity lover, but that doesn't mean that that's right for an abundance lover. But sometimes people are sort of like, well, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me that I can find every, I have all these papers on my desk. I can put my hands on anything I want in a flash. I know where everything is, and I kind of like having it all around me. I see these unexpected juxtapositions. I feel like that makes me more creative. Then that's working for you. That's fine for you. You're an abundance lover. You thrive in that environment. There's nothing wrong with you. And why should your boss tell you that you have to replicate what works for the boss? People are different. And so I think sometimes by understanding, well, people thrive in different environments, it's like it takes away the judgment. Some people have very strong emotional attachment to objects. And some people don't have such emotional attachment to objects. And so sometimes the people who don't feel that powerful pull are very judgmental of the people who are really finding it difficult to let go of something because it really means something. It's like, well, how can I get rid of this desk? This was my grandfather's desk, and I loved him so much. And every time I see this desk, even though it doesn't really fit in my New York City apartment, it reminds me of my grandfather. And if I give away the desk, it's like, in a way, I'm relinquishing my grandfather. You have to recognize that and honor that feeling and help the person understand how they can hang on to their love for their grandfather in a way that can allow them to let go of the desk. And usually people can do that, but you have to respect that they have this feeling towards the possession. It's not enough to just be like, everybody should have, you know, like you should get rid of everything. Stuff doesn't matter. Stuff does matter. And you have to think about that as you're trying to create the outer order that really might help you thrive.
Well, I'm really glad you said that, because it really shows that you've cultivated over this time so many different ideas and advice and tips that people will hear, and you don't really know which one is going to work for you. So I would love for people to pay more attention. And our guest, Gretchen Rubin, was doing an evening lecture and book signing Tuesday, March 5th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. It's sponsored by the New York Open Center. Its location is the Community Church of New York, 40 East 35th Street, New York, 10016. So you could probably go there and register in person. But just to make sure that you do have the room, that you can pre-register by going to opencenter.org and you look for Gretchen Rubin, GRETCHENRUBIN. And you could also go to her website, GretchenRubin.com. And really, actually, I happen to be one of these people that deals with clutter. So in this conversation alone, Gretchen, you've given me some really, really good counsel, and I appreciate that. So I encourage
people. Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
Attention. So I want to thank you very much. Out of time, if you have a few words you'd like to share with people, please do that.
I would just underscore something that you said, which is there is no one magic solution for everyone. We all have to do this in the way that's right for us, that matches our challenges and our interests and our values and our possessions. And so if one way doesn't work for you, try a different way. There's a lot of ways to achieve our aims. Don't beat yourself up if somebody says, oh, this is the way you have to do it, and that way doesn't work for you. There's a lot of things to try. Just move on and try something else, and you will find a way for you to make yourself happier, healthier, more productive, more creative in the way that's right for you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Gretchen Rubin, for joining me today. And I'm sure you can connect with everything Gretchen has to share at GretchenRubin.com. I want to say bye for now to all of our listeners. You've been listening to Heart of Mind, Radio for the New Millennium, over the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. And if you go to the archive for Heart of Mind Radio, you will see the links to everything you heard today, and you can make that connection very easily and right away. And share this with your friends. All of us has that friend that needs to know how to declutter. Share. All right, thank you, and bye for now. Thank you.